pushes the button.
Hi. Welcome to Literary in Italy. Follow us on Facebook at Literary Italy, on Instagram at Literary Italy Podcast, on Twitter at Literary Italy. Send us mail at mail@literaryitaly.com. Our website address is www.literaryitaly.com. I have a monkey clapping over here. My wife Anne, my monkey wife. Ooh, it's what you said it first. You said you're clapping.
When I said it was funny. When you say it, it's not funny.
That's why you're laughing so much.
Greetings, everyone. Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome to December, and welcome to another episode of Literary Italy.
Yay.
Today we're going to talk a little bit about Christmas traditions.
Today we're not going to talk about anything. We're just going to let it be.
In Italy. Specifically Christmas traditions in Naples, and our author this week is Matilde Serao. And we chose a short piece by Serao that is really just a very rich description of Naples at Christmas time.
Yes.
But this is also a good excuse to talk about Christmas in Italy, because it's a great time. I mean, it's for sure the biggest and most popular holiday in Italy. And I know that this episode is going to be coming out December 6th, which is still quite a way before Christmas. But, you know, the Christmas season in Italy starts fairly early. Now, you know, of course, here in the United States, it gets earlier and earlier. I actually saw this year, right after they were clearing out the back-to-school stuff in September, I began seeing.
I want to point out that our episodes are timeless, so you can listen to them anytime. You could even be listening to this in
July.
In the year 2525, around Christmas time, and you're going to go, oh, that's
right.
That's really awesome.
So in addition, you know, but there isn't a Thanksgiving. I think in the United States, a lot of times people start preparing for Christmas around Thanksgiving. Now it's gotten even earlier. But in Italy, traditionally, the preparations for Christmas begin during the 4 weeks of Advent, first leading up to Christmas, and also more popularly from around December 8th, which is the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, right on up till Christmas, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and then the 12 days of Christmas after. So you really have like a whole month of celebrating.
And in some places, do they do anything for the Feast of St. Nicholas, which
yes.
I think is?
Yes, sure.
What day is the Feast of St. Nicholas? Do you remember? Is it the 5th or the 6th?
The 6th.
6th.
It's December 6th. It's, the day that this podcast is going to be released. So St. Nicholas is not an Italian saint. However, his body is in Bari, in the Cathedral Church of San Nicola, because it was stolen by the Barese, because there's a legend that St. Nicholas came that way at some point during his life, and he saw the town. He said, I want to be buried there. That's a beautiful place. I want to be.
But he lived in Turkey, right?
Yes. And so
Turkey.
Mira, the town that he lived in, became a Muslim stronghold. That was kind of a good excuse to go in and steal St. Nicholas's body and bring him back to Italy. It was a little bit of a war between Venice and Bari, who would get the body of St. Nicholas, but he ended up in Bari in 1087.
And it was, of course, anachronistic of me to say Turkey, because obviously Turkey didn't exist at the time. That would have been the Eastern Empire. He would have been in Cappadocia or Anatolia.
A little bit, you know, the Feast of St. Nicholas, for sure, there is this figure of St. Nicholas who kind of looks like Santa Claus, who gives candy. You can, in different areas of Italy, you might put your shoes out and get treats. It really varies. I think that's one of the things I wanted to talk about today, is just that when we talk about Italian Christmas traditions, this is sort of like, I think, when we talked about Italian cuisine, that in a way there is no such thing as Italian cuisine. There's no one cuisine for the entire country of Italy. It's really very regional. And so are many of these Christmas traditions. Since we're going to be talking about Serao today, who is Neapolitan, we're going to be focusing on Neapolitan Christmas traditions. But I think perhaps we could do another episode. Talk about...
We can do like 17 episodes.
Yeah, we could do like an episode every day. Yeah. We could do the 12 episodes of Christmas.
Right. We could do an advent calendar of Christmas.
You open up episodes. A door and there's another Christmas tradition.
And there's Anne clapping
like a monkey.
Chimes like a monkey.
So Matilde Serao, born in 1856 in Greece. Her mother was Greek. Her father was Neapolitan, and they were living in Greece because her father opposed the Bourbon. He was a patriot. He was for the unification of Italy.
Why did he oppose the Bourbon? Because I like the Bourbon.
Jim is all for Bourbon.
The Bourbon.
But they moved back to Naples when she was a young woman. She attended school. And she was really kind of a fascinating person.
Hmm.
Gifted writer. She attended school, which would have prepared her to be a teacher, but she did not want to be a teacher. She became a writer. And so from fairly early on, she began writing as a journalist and then as a novelist. She spent most of her life then in Naples, except for several years in Rome. And it was in Rome where she met her husband, Eduardo Scerfoglio, who was also another journalist who worked at the paper. I think it was Il Corriere di Roma,
mm-hmm.
was the paper that they founded together. She had four children with Eduardo, but their marriage was kind of a farce. And they sort of kept up because, they were professionally, they were professionally working together, but personally things were sort of falling apart with his philandering. And, ultimately they ended up separating, I believe it was, I don't know. Remember, they did move back to Naples, and I think they separated 1902. And after that, she really she founded her own paper, Il Giorno, in 1904 mm-hmm. in Naples. And that's pretty significant. I think she's the first Italian woman to take that leadership role with a newspaper like that. And it's not just the newspaper. She also had weekly literary reviews. In addition, as I said, she herself was an author of about 40 novels and also short stories. And one of the things that's interesting about her, she really focuses in her writing a lot about the lower classes, especially Naples, this very realistic, she has different periods in her writing, different kinds of styles in her writing, but she's most known for this focus on the lower classes in Naples and especially women. So love affairs and women's friendship with other women. And she's very concerned, it's a world that's really dominated by women and their relationships, whether they're with men or with other women or mothers and daughters and things like that. And she also really highlights, this unfair, just sort of the struggles of the lower classes. And it's not just struggles like they're trying to make money, but it's also like, she highlights the cholera epidemic and the lack of resources given to people in Naples. She's really kind of a fascinating person. She was conservative in her politics. She opposed Italy's role in World War I, and she was also an anti-fascist and outspoken about that, and that may be part of the reason why Italy did not support her in the nomination for the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1926, which actually went to Grazia Deledda, the Sardinian writer that we talked about many, many episodes ago. But she's a fascinating person. She's a fascinating person. She was close friends with Eleonora Duse, who was a famous Italian actress.
Say it. She was a Duse.
She was a Duse. And she was Gabriele D'Annunzio's girlfriend.
She was my girlfriend.
So we'll talk about a little bit more about Duse in when we
in
talk
due
about,
time
in when
due
we talk
time,
about yeah. D'Annunzio. But today we're going to talk about this very short. I mean, I think we're going to be able to read most of it out loud. You're going to read the whole thing.
Oh, I'm going to read the whole thing. Oh yeah. I'm going to read the whole thing. I might even tear into the phone book afterwards.
Well, all right. So this comes from a collection, this particular, you know, that called A Very Italian Christmas, which I saw the title and I sort of impulsively bought it because I thought, oh, this will be fun. I have to tell you, these are the most depressing stories I have.
Now we've also ordered for our younger son of what is it? A Very Russian Christmas.
And
we are the odds. The money is better than even that is going to be more depressing than
Italian Christmas. So typical, there is actually another Serao story, which is, in this collection called Canituccia, which initially I thought, well, maybe we could do that. But Canituccia is the story of a little girl whose mother, now I forget who she becomes pregnant with, but she is a woman of ill repute and she goes off and she becomes a prostitute. So Canituccia, this little girl, is left with a couple who despise her really because of the circumstances of her conception and of her birth. And she has only one friend in the world, and that's a little pig.
Oh.
Yeah, called Cicotto.
And it doesn't end well for Cicotto.
Well, and you know that if Christmas is coming, right. Christmas is coming, and your
I reminded you that Christmas was coming for Wilbur in Charlotte's Web. And
well, this is like Charlotte's Web without Charlotte.
Right.
This is what would have happened to Cicotto. So it does not end well. And so it was just kind of really. And then at the end, you know, everyone has a big feast, and I think it ends. The little girl said no by simply shaking her head, even though she was dying of hunger. Okay. So I thought, okay, let's not do Canituccia because it's so depressing. So instead, we're going to read this short, I don't know, story, this short, it's really almost like a painting of Christmas in Naples. And it's called To the Tenth Muse. The tenth muse being gastronomy. Right? It would be the muse of good eating. So do you want to read perhaps maybe the first paragraph?
I'm going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to go.
Well, let's read the first paragraph and talk about it.
We'll see how it goes. Okay. Let's see where the spirit moves us. To the tenth muse. Up above, a calm and quiet little room with a sweetly warm ambiance. A lamp pours its even, restful light over the pages of a good book. Here and there, a smile of friendship or of love. The hours pass slowly and placidly, like lovely, languid people. Down below, the wet and muddy street, slippery with mire, is trampled by thousands of feet. A thick fog made of smoke, dampness, scirocco, people's breath, the darkness violently pierced by gas lights, smoking oil lamps, the reddish light of torches, the vivid colors of the Bengala, the comings, goings.
Holiday and fireworks.
Yes, those are fireworks. The vivid colors of the fireworks, the comings, goings, encounters, and cries of a crowd that is dense, constant, ever-changing, and the talks, laughs, shouts, makes a din, sings and yells, a clamor that courses over the whole range of pitch, from the highest to the lowest tones, with the wildest shifts from an extremely high-pitched racket to a deep thunderclap. Although the shutters are closed and the double walls are lined, echoes of that uproar make their way to the reader. Distracted, he listens and smiles. The room temperature is pleasant. The carpet is soft. The light is soothing. The book displays the appeal of its pale yellow paper, its tapered lettering, its whimsical ornaments and verses, but all in vain. The great voice of the crowd is insistent, rising and resounding like a powerful summons. Then the reader is possessed by nostalgia for the street, the fog, the hustle and bustle. He feels a sharp desire to go down into that tumult, to enjoy that scene, to contribute his part to it, to feel small, insignificant, and lost in it. He no longer fights against this desire, but yields to it. And with an enormous sigh, the street triumphs over the little room.
Ah. Okay. Punto. You say tumult. I say tumult.
I say tumult.
I say tumult.
I also say tumescent.
So do I. Okay. So I guess we won't call the whole thing off.
Yeah.
That's how she introduces this.
That's what she said.
This short, really, it's an homage. It's a dedication to the 10th muse.
Well, we haven't really gotten to the 10th muse yet.
No, because this reader is being called out of this nice toasty room to get down into the streets of Naples and see what's going on.
Yeah. But there's a kind of seduction and a kind of violence that's happening just in this first paragraph. There's a kind of barrage of the senses that pulls you out of your reverie and pulls you away from reflection and draws you into the immediate world.
Yeah. The great voice of the crowd is insistent, rising and resounding like a powerful summons.
And the reader is no longer a reader once this happens, right? Do you think you're no longer a reader in that moment.
Yeah. You know, one of the things is that it's just so sensory, you know, both the eyes and the ears, and then she gets into the smells, become taken over, you know, that you can no longer read.
Right. So far it's been mostly the hearing and the sight. There's a lot of light and there's a lot of sound, but so far there's no smell or taste, but oh, that's coming.
Right.
Dear listener.
This is really the Ghost of Christmas Present. Huh. The whole thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right. There is no past. There is no future. It's all present.
It's all immediate. It's the now.
Sure. Can I do the next paragraph?
You can do the next paragraph.
All the riches of the vegetable and animal kingdoms lie jumbled in profusion in the squares and streets. Here's the triumph of meat. There are rows of chickens hung by the legs with their yellowish, firm skin, lightly dotted with brown and veined with pale, light blue. There are turkeys, fat and round, swinging somberly in the sirocco with the same seriousness as if they were still alive. The flickering torchlight puts into strange profile enormous heaps of veal, whose whitish flesh is bloody, with long, strong muscle fibers and smooth, polished, unblemished bones, and fully illuminates the white suckling pigs with their almost elegant figures. That's the poor little girls.
There's Wilbur.
That's the poor little girl's little pig, which are the tender, juicy, and preferred meal of fine ladies and priests. You walk forever and see only meat, and then that smell of freshly slaughtered animals, that dripping reddish-brown blood, those sharp and decisive knife strokes, lead you to feel melancholy and disgust. The triumph of full, fat, heavy, insolent matter, smiling at its own death that is a new life and at once provocative and sickening, ends up crushing you. With a sense of fear, you think of that luxury, that excess, that exuberance, that enormity, and anxiously you seek out milder sensations.
Yeah.
It's pretty fantastic, her whole, like, disgust and... provocative and sickening.
Two words I don't normally associate with Christmas are melancholy and disgust.
Melancholy, yes. Melancholy is very commonly associated with Christmas.
Yeah, says you.
Says me. So she moves on from the meat, you know, from the butchers to the greengrocers, to the... You know, we're here.
Yeah, so the most surprising thing for me is that I've never thought of tacchino. I've never thought of turkey.
Turkey is a common Christmas meat for a stuffed. And it wouldn't be the whole turkey like we think of in the United States, where you have that huge turkey stuffed and the whole family, Norman Rockwell, the whole family around. In Italy, there is tacchino, turkey, usually stuffed. And it's usually, do you remember? All right, so years ago, we were in Florence.
I do remember the turkey.
And we asked for, you know, you kind of have to special request it because it is not that common a meat in Italy. And we asked for a turkey.
But here it is. It's hanging up in the butcher shops here, not waiting for American tourists. This is in Naples.
Yeah, that is a full turkey.
Yeah.
Fat and round.
But we can talk about what we had. So what we had was basically it was like a turkey. It was a turkey breast or a turkey cutlet, roll, yeah, cutlet that was stuffed with prosciutto and other meat.
Yeah.
I mean, it was stuffed with ham. It was delicious. And it was kind of wrapped in a, you know, in string and right, tied off.
Right. Well, I remember when I was in the butcher shop and I was asking for this turkey and ordered it. And the woman, the butcher,
I cooked it in a toaster oven because that's all
Oh, this was actually a different Thanksgiving that we were there, where the butcher,
this is with your other husband.
No, this was another year that we were there and in a different.
Oh, yeah.
That was in 2001.
In 2001, right.
So yeah. I remember that the butcher, she turned to some of the other patrons in the shop and she said, you know, Americans really like that turkey for this feast, you know, because the feast of Thanksgiving holiday is not.
It's an American
thing.
American.
And she said, but it's really disgusting because the turkey is so big that it just dries out. And she said, it's just a stupid, and I was standing right there and she knew that I could understand Italian. And she said, it's just a stupid thing that they should have such a big, because I think in that case, we did get a whole turkey. I think there is a way to cook it
so that it doesn't dry.
Well, see, that's the whole thing is that cooking a turkey, it's all about doing all these tricks and things to keep it from drying out because it is a dry meat. And having one that's like 22 pounds or whatever.
But there are general rules, general gastronomic rules about how you deal with poultry. Let's see that monkey start clapping again. Clap, monkey, clap.
Well, so yes. Anyway, we got to the turkey. Yeah. We got
Oh, so my turn. Do I get to read now?
You want
to
read? Okay, yes. Now you can do the vegetables. The herbs. I wish I had done the vegetables.
Oh, I wish I had done the meat. Because it's so stinky. Okay. We get to as she ended the last one, anxiously you seek out milder sensations, and that's the vegetables. Next, there come into view herbs, greens, fruits, a veritable vegetable sweetness, the tribute of the countryside, the offering of the fields and forests. The little mounds of green broccoli, whose flowers look like pointed lacework, gaze with disdain at the humble little chicory, harvested in small bunches, on which droplets of water are shining. The large, tightly closed white cabbages seem to want to burst from their wrapper of light green leaves, while the black cabbages blend with the darkness, almost as if seeking solitude. The rippling light, when people or carriages pass by, a sudden burst of fireworks, a supervening shadow, all these contribute to the fantastic nature of this scene. Proportions seem to grow in size. You lose your sense of reality and seem to be walking in fields of marjoram and clover between two hedges made of vegetables, while at the end, as a horizon, the yellow flame of a pyramid of oranges is lit like a souvenir of Sicilian sunsets. The sharp, sometimes inebriating scent of apples reaches your brain. There is also the sweeter and somewhat older scent of pears brought out of winter storage, and the subtle, light, and exhilarating effluvium of mandarins. But a stronger and healthier smell drives away all the others, replacing them and becoming the sole ruler. Oh, who is this ruler that's approaching in?
Well, it's Naples.
No.
No, I'm saying it's Naples, so you know it's going to have to be
it's going
to
be fish.
Seafood. Yeah. Right. You now enter the domain of the sea in small fringed seaweed baskets, looking like the loose hair of a beautiful dead water nymph. Eels with brown backs and pale bellies quiver, writhe, and twist themselves in knots, while lobsters, usually so calm and resigned, agitate their long pointed legs. Pink mullets move their fins a little in order to breathe. Oysters open their shells ever so slightly. And razor clams, known as cannolicchi, in Naples, soleni, slip out of their long cases almost as if seeking freedom. Codfish have died in a desperate position, their bodies half twisted with tails raised, almost as if they had suffered a slow and painful end. They probably did. Other more dignified fish, convinced of their fate, stayed still and proud. There is nonstop spraying of seawater and loud, robust cries coming from the chests of men who have battled gales. These are sinewy, swarthy fishermen with bare legs and arms who are happy to offer you their wares. The sea, the good old sea, that beneficent curmudgeon, that lavish eternal grumbler, very willingly gave up a little of its wealth and left its grandiose calling card in this colossal display. Let's have a smile and recall playful summer swims, the coolness of the waves, and rocks crowned with sea foam.
But the glow of gaslight, refracted in shiny faceted crystals, in gilded ornaments, in silver sequins, in brightly colored satins, draws your gaze to a store window or two or three. Here are the sweets, with light, graceful, simple forms resembling flowers, fruit, hearts, and butterflies, with delicate, soft colors, such as translucent pink, opalescent green, grayish white, and pale violet, all of which melt together and blend into a palette of pastels pleasing to the eye. There are soft, fluffy foams looking as though they might vanish in a single puff of air if a single puff of air were to touch them. Wobbling creams, either white or yellow, candied fruit, covered with a silvery transparent film in shiny cascades. The solemn weightiness of nougats and dark brown chocolate in all its forms and aspects. Light puff pastries that dissolve when you bite into them. Dates stuffed with pistachios in a most noble union like that of milk and honey. It is, in short, the gathering of all that is finest, most tender and elegant. These are caresses for the senses of sight, taste, and smell. In these sweets, refinement and deliciousness are given their most complete embodiment. We may find here the culmination of every desire, no matter how extraordinary, the highest and purest poetry of human sensations. Fantasy that has been brought to life, the artistic ideal made real, the summum of art itself. With this sublime lyric flight concludes the splendid hymn that the people of Naples have dedicated to the 10th muse, Gastarea.
Gastarea being, as we said, this
gastronomic.
Right.
Muse of gastronomy, the muse of the belly.
And that's really what this is. This is kind of a hymn, a sort of hymn to gastronomy.
Right.
But I think especially it's not gluttony. It's not gluttony.
No. But it's a kind of a pagan hymn, though. It's that sort of singing me, O muse. There's not very much Christmas going on.
Although, so we'll talk now about the Neapolitan, because Christmas traditions, because she does talk about some of the foods
that are
traditional foods. Now, when you talk about Italian Christmas traditions, one of the things I think here in the United States, the first thing people will say is, oh, the Feast of the Seven Fishes on Christmas Eve. And this apparently is a common tradition among Italian-American households where they'll have seven different kinds of fish on Christmas Eve. It's funny because I had lived in Rome, I had lived in Florence, I'd never heard of this, and I thought, well, maybe it's just a Southern thing. And it is true that fish is much more common to have Christmas Eve in Southern Italy, other parts of Italy too, baccalà maybe, and other parts. But this idea of the seven and this importance of the seven is not an Italy-wide tradition. It could be that the seven refers to the 7 days of creation. In some traditions, you have nine different kinds of fish. Some people will do 12 for the 12 apostles. And I think the focus, though, is on the fish. And some of that, the tradition of having fish on Christmas Eve comes from the idea that Advent is sort of like a mini Lent. Mm-hmm. And so that Advent would be a time of abstaining. And so you would abstain right up until Christmas Day. Now, you are abstaining, but you're having a feast. And so you're having a feast of as many different kinds of fish that you can find Christmas Eve. Another tradition in Italy, all over Italy, not just Naples, is after having that Christmas Eve feast, you might go to midnight mass, which is not at midnight usually. It's usually like 10 o'clock or something that would finish at midnight. And then perhaps go home and have some more food, maybe dessert, and open up presents. So some of the fish, some of the foods that are traditional, one I think I mentioned is baccalà, which is the salted cod. And another that's very traditional, especially for Naples, is capitone, this eel that's usually eaten deep fried. Haven't had it. I mean, I think I've only ever had eel in sushi.
Mm.
And the only thing I remember in seeing, so I, one of my uncles was a fisherman on Long Island. And I remember one time we went to visit and he said, "Hey kids, come on, see what I have in the back of my truck." And he had a barrel full of eels that they were alive and they were all wiggling around. And it was very impressive to a child. And he said he was taking them to Chinatown, that he was selling, that's where he sold eels. That's where there was a demand for eels. And I remember thinking, who on earth would eat eels? Now I love eel, at least in sushi. So I will have to try it sometime fried. Another way of having another seafood that's traditional would be spaghetti alle vongole,
mm-hmm.
which of course, you know, that's the little clams, spaghetti with little clams. And there are other ways, you know, I think some of it, sometimes this tradition of seven kinds of fish is there, it becomes a almost like a challenge to try to find different ways of coming up with seven different. And it's not that there is actually a real tradition of having these seven, and that if you don't have the seven, something terrible is going to happen to you. But certainly seafood or fish on Christmas Eve is traditional. I mean, we mentioned the turkey, that would be Christmas Day. Possibly you might have ham, tortellini and brodo, you know, like as a first course, you would have little tortellini in broth. And also in Naples, specifically in Naples, what's typical for the desserts are these struffoli, which are these little fried dough balls that are kind of covered in honey and sprinkles. I don't know if you remember that. I mean, you do find them, like they'll actually build little pyramids or like Christmas tree looking towers out of them. They're really good. So that's some of the foods that would be typical for a Neapolitan Christmas. And, you know, she talks too about, you know, that it's very clear this is a market. So the market, the main market in Naples is the Porto Nolana market. And that's where you would find, you know, that's really what I like about this piece is it's as though you're walking through this market. So you're passing by the butchers, you're passing by the meats, then you get into the vegetables and then the fruits, and then you get into the seafood area. And then finally, you know, you top it off with dessert. I really like that. I think that you can't talk about Christmas in Naples without talking about the presepio. That's the creche, or the manger scene, the nativity scene that typically has Mary, Joseph, and baby Jesus, and then usually also the three wise men, some shepherds, the camel with the wise men, sheep. In addition, so this is a big tradition in Naples. They have lots of these little figurines. The street that you can go to find them, to buy them, you know, even if you're there in the summer, you can go and buy some of these figures, is Via San Gregorio Armeno. And that's famous for these figurines, for the presepi.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to the traditional, you know, Mary, Joseph, and baby, and the three wise men, you can also find figures from political, you know, politics. You'll probably find a Donald Trump figure or like an Elvis figure, or maybe Berlusconi, or someone, you know, kind of tucked in the background. In most churches in Italy around Christmas, you will find a presepio, you know, this large nativity scene that has Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, of course, at the center, but that expands out and often shows a whole hillside with shepherds and you know, more elaborate, maybe even other houses and things like that. They can actually be really large, these prosapi. And the churches will have them for several weeks. So if you're in Italy around Christmas time, definitely stop into the churches. It's always fun to kind of see how different churches present this nativity scene, you know, and it's a source of pride, I think, for the parishioners to kind of show what they've, you know, they wait all year to show this. And it's, and they're usually exposed, they're out for several weeks. Baby Jesus is probably not put into the manger until Christmas Day, but the other scene is there out that you can check out. What else? For in Naples, it's traditional to play tombolo, which is a game like bingo. Also, what you would hear, not just in Naples, but particularly in smaller towns in southern Italy, is the zampognari, which is the Italian bagpipes. And I know this kind of surprised me the first time I heard bagpipes in Italy, because I think of bagpipes as Scotland and Ireland. And there is a big tradition of Italian bagpipes. The zampognari are the ones who play these players. And they'll just kind of come on in the town with their bagpipes and play, and, you know, for people to give money, that kind of thing. So, you know, as we mentioned, December 8th, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, is a national holiday. It's worth keeping in mind if you're going to Italy in December, just to be aware that that's a national holiday. So trains are not going to be running. They'll be running on a holiday schedule. And also Christmas, the 26th and the 20, I'm sorry, Christmas, the 25th and the 26th, which is the Feast of St. Stephen, are both national holidays. In addition, you know, so the 12 days of Christmas start on Christmas Day and they go for 12 days after. They end with the Feast of the Epiphany on January 6th. And we're going to do another episode on New Year's and Epiphany and the traditions that surround the Epiphany. But Christmas for sure is the biggest holiday in Italy. I think this is kind of signified by that saying, Natale con I tuoi, Pasqua con chi vuoi, which means Christmas with your family, Easter with whoever you want. Mm-hmm. You know, that. So the idea is that Christmas, you really got to go home. Another tradition, now this is more going up to northern Italy, is that tradition of the Settimana Bianca, where the white week, which means that you would go skiing in that week. But a lot of people have off between Christmas and New Year's, so you would go skiing. But that would not be Naples. You wouldn't have a Settimana Bianca in Naples.
No skiing in Naples.
Yeah. So anything else that you want to add about Matilda Serao, or anything that came as you were reading this about Gastarea?
No. All those dead animals hanging out. Dead animals that bring new life.
Yeah, it's to read this in conjunction with the Canituccia, that story that I told you about the poor orphan girl whose best friend is a little piglet. It gives a different sense to this story as well.
Great. No, let's do something next week for more Christmas stuff.
All right. So, have a wonderful week and enjoy. If you have any ideas for episodes, whether readings, authors, works, or places in Italy, I'm sure we can dig up something. Give us a shout. You can send us at contact us at mail@literaryitaly.com, or contact us through our Facebook page.
Send us an email. That's the best.
Email is kind of old fashioned.
Yeah, but no one's gonna. Whatever. You know where we live. All right. Alla prossima.
Okay. Enjoy.